Why go to all the trouble of experiencing the great outdoors for yourself when you can listen to a few Northwest Outdoor experts yap about it? This is The Outdoor Line with Tom Nelson, Rob Ensley, and Joey Pyburn on 710 ESPN Seattle and the 710 ESPN Seattle app. The Outdoor Line is brought to you by Yamaha, Sportco Outdoor Emporium, Lowrance, Weldcraft, and Duckworth Boats, Roy Robinson Chevrolet, Kitsap Marina, Harbor Marine, Truck Vault, and Ray Marine Electronics.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of The Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN Seattle. That's Joey Pyburn, Rob Ensley. Coming at us from Gig Harbor, Matt Nelson in our Seattle studios. And if I've learned anything from Rob Ensley and Joey Pyburn about hunting is, if you can't see them, you can't eat them. Mark Boardman joining us of Vortex Optics, the product experience manager of Vortex Optics, still the best job title in the United States of America. Mark Boardman, good morning, man.
Morning, Mark.
Gentlemen. Good morning, and yes, truer words never spoken, Rob.
We were telling hunting stories yesterday, man, and you know, it never fails. We talk about our Vortex products, and it just leads right into hunting stories. And Joe and I, of course, this week, we're excited to have you on and talk about all the Vortex stuff going on. But really, it all boils down to what we do in the field with this stuff. I mean, gosh, Joe and I were deer hunting in Idaho last year, and he's using his range finding binocs to call out ranges to me. It was almost like almost a military situation there.
Yeah, you know, I'm laying on the ground. That's what it felt like.
And my deer's running. I had a chance to shoot it at 180 yards. Of course, I screwed it up. Now the damn thing's running, and Joe's calling out ranges, and none of that was possible without those range finding binoculars. And finally, it stopped at 320 yards, and I was able to knock that thing down. But those darn Fury binoculars, man, we've had just great luck with those in the field. And I know you had a similar experience coyote hunting in Nebraska here recently with your rangefinders. So I just kind of wanted to share some of those stories this morning and talk about some of that stuff, buddy.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and that scenario that you described, I mean, that is really like the perfect storm for needing a rangefinding binocular, right? You've got an animal, it's on the move, things are happening fast. Obviously, you fired that first shot, you know, everything is kind of going down at once, and be able to stay on that animal with a set of binoculars, be able to watch it, see where it's going, see how it's positioned, call out those ranges to you real time so you can make adjustments as needed. And then, of course, with the new Fury HD 5000 AB rangefinder binocular with the onboard applied ballistics, you can call out ballistic solutions to a person or get them for yourself as that situation is unfolding. So, yeah, just a really, really handy piece. You know, we always like multi-purpose functionality. That's a lot of things in one unit. And, I mean, overall, I think it can make you, a more efficient hunter. And like you said, we're just Jim and I have been – that's who I co-host the Vortex Nation podcast with a little plug there. But we've been creating some coyote-related content. I did a podcast with a really cool guy, Greg Schroeder from Fur Harvesters Auction, Inc. He's been in the fur game for like 40 years and just, you know, a wealth of knowledge in that regard. So we chatted with him about putting up fur. And then another guy, Matt McHugh, about, you know, kind of the coyote tactics. Put those all that stuff into practice on a long road trip to Nebraska. Why you drive 10 hours to go kill a coyote, I'm not still really sure, but it's a lot of fun. And we finally got on some, though, and got a visual on them. We kind of kept pushing in on this group that we got to light up using some coyote vocalizations. And it was a group of four, from what we could tell. They're about, well, I don't know they're about. They were 1,062 yards away because I ranged them with the Fury HD, was laid out prone, had my ballistic solution, you know, had I wanted to try and execute that shot, which is definitely a poke. Obviously, we chose to call and got one to come into 100 yards, and Jim got it. So, but just a really cool story, you know, had those dogs just sat there and we didn't think we could get closer, or maybe you could get a little bit closer, but not as close as you want to get, you know, you're going to be able to get that ballistic solution. And another cool part of that is, when I've made like my dope charts in the past, I still will. I'll go into the field and I'll have a dope chart taped to my stock, right? I want that information. But when I make that, I'm going to make that for like some general parameters, like 50 degrees, you know, this elevation, right? Well, when we were hunting, you know, at the lowest temp, I think, was -18, and the highest temp was -10. So when I made my dope chart for 50 degrees, That's a big swing. And then you start stacking those tolerances, and you might be looking at a miss without something like that Fury AB with all the onboard environmental sensors.
Yeah. No, there's so many variables when you're out hunting. Temperature, humidity, I mean, everything, elevation, all that
it
stuff.
It happens fast. All of it happens so fast.
Yeah, I mean, that situation you and I were in, Rob, you know, that deer was obviously stationary at 180. I range him. And the cool thing about those Fury HD 5000s is you just hold the button down. You don't, it's not like a rangefinder, you know, old school rangefinders. You had to push the button. Mm-hmm. And then if the deer moved, you got to push the button again. This, I just held it down. The deer starts running. Well, it stood there for a long time.
Oh, trust me, it was there for a long time.
Yeah.
And my bipod leg, the little spring on it, I couldn't get it to lock in it. And it kind of goes, tick, tick. And I'm like, oh, he turns around, looks at me like,
the deer looked right at us.
And he took off.
And then he starts moving, but, you know, happens fast. The deer's on the move now. I just hold the button down. He's cruising out, you know, stops again. Stops for just a second at like 240, and I'm able to call the distance. Maybe stopped again at like 3, but then was back on the move. He didn't really have a shot. He was facing away from us. Yeah. Finally stopped broadside 340-ish, and Rob was able to put the smack down on him. But, you know, it's funny. I pretty much all I use now for my Western hunts are those 10x42 Fury HDs. Those things they're so crystal clear, and if you pair them with a good lightweight stable tripod, it's a deadly glassing system. I mean, I know Rob, he's more of he likes to get a comfortable backrest and kind of hunker down into his binoculars. I prefer to take the time to, and it's, what's it take me, Rob? A minute to get my tripod out and get my binoculars on. But that minute that it takes me allows me to have a total stable glassing platform. And look, man, I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I outglass most all the guys that I hunt with.
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at a clear, stable picture.
Stable. It's the stability of the whole thing.
The amount of movement you have, and it, a 10x42, you can hold those binoculars fairly stable. As you start moving up into a 15 or an 18 power, you can't hold the magnification's too great. You have to have them on a tripod if you want to be successful at glassing. But it's always fun, you know. Glassing is, once you get good at it, it's so much fun. It's like, I don't know, I dream about it. I'll fall asleep sometimes, and I'll dream about waking up,
getting out of my tent, and just sitting behind
my glasses all day, glassing for deer.
People dream about money, women, drugs, rock and roll, whatever. We dream about glassing for deer.
I'm like, I had the most cool dream last night. I was glassing, and I was seeing so many deer.
Mark Boardman of Vortex Optics joining us this morning. Mark, and we were talking yesterday about getting set up for glassing. I mean, Vortex has taken a couple steps in this direction with a brand new set, or brand new line of tripods, but also talk to us about how we can mount our binos to those tripods, because that's not a scenario that a lot of guys are familiar with, and they really should if they want to become Joey Pyburn-esque in their proficiency with glassing.
So, yeah, let's definitely hit on that. I do want to backtrack a little bit and talk about a couple things that Joey touched on when he was talking about using that scan mode with the binocular or the rangefinder binocular, or really any of our rangefinders. That's a really cool feature, you know, because oftentimes when you press that button, you do create a little bit of movement, you know, by that action. And that could take you off the mark that you're trying to hit. So you can press that button down, hold it, even if it's on a stationary optic, and it's going to give you like 375, 375, 375. And if you move off it a little bit, or maybe you hit some trees to the side that are closer, you can really tell and confirm your range there. So that scan mode is a hot tip there. And then, you know, spotting movement by not moving. You know, I mean, what are we looking for most in the field, or oftentimes, you know, you're looking movement. For a deer that moves. That's what you see. And when your binos are rock solid stationary, you're going to spot so much movement there. And to get those stationary binoculars, like you said, Tom, you need a good tripod. And we've got some new tripods that really, really fit the bill. You know, I'll probably talk about one just because it's my favorite of the group. And it's the new Summit Carbon 2. It's lightweight. It's compact. It's coming in at 2.5 pounds. And you couple that thing with the new Pro Binocular Tripod Bino Adapter, and you are looking at an incredibly flyweight, stable, fluid panning setup. It's gonna make you a better hunter. That leg set on that Summit Carbon 2 is super short. It's gonna fit in a ton of pockets designed to hold a tripod on your pack. It can fit in your pack. I guess I just can't say enough things about it. It really takes carrying a tripod. It's not a burden anymore. Like you don't have an excuse to not take it with you. And the more you use it, the more you're going to want to take it with you. And I don't know. I'm just super jacked about it. I can't get enough of it.
Go ahead, Joe. Yeah.
And one thing with the tripod setup. So your binos go on, just boom, they're on, and you can just pick them up and take them back off and boom, right into your bino case. And then when I'm actively hunting and glassing, sometimes I'm only moving a couple hundred yards, right, to move to a different glassing point. I don't put my tripod back on my backpack. I almost use it like a trekking pole. Gotcha. I just pick it up. Gotcha. They weigh 2 pounds.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I like having that tripod in my hand because it allows me to walk and not look at where my feet are going. I almost use it like a blind person would use a walking stick, right? It allows me to keep scanning, looking for game. I have that tripod just kind of keeping contact with the ground in front of me. And if I see something, boom, I'm right back on the tripod, right on the binos, and looking at deer.
So how fast does that Vortex Pro Bino adapter come on and off the binos? Because I'm assuming you leave that adapter on the tripod, because I got to confess, I have never used a binocular adapter for tripods before.
Yeah, well, the adapter will stay on your binoculars.
Oh, it stays on the binos. Gotcha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And that'll pop.
Yeah,
that'll pop just
really.
Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, I was gonna say this one is a really slick setup because it's just got this, you know, little stud that threads into the front of the bino. So like if you picture any of our binoculars, we kind of have like that logo cap on the front, you know, on the objective end of the binocular. You just thread that out. You thread this little stud in, and then it plugs right into this, I guess, vertical post, I guess, for lack of a better term. And I just keep that right on the plate. So I carry an extra tripod plate, which all of our new tripods have Arca Swiss plates, which is a super common plate. They're really slick. And so I just keep that on there. If you're swapping in between your spotting scope and your binoculars, you know, you can have a couple systems there where you have two plates on each optic. But oftentimes I'm just carrying a binocular, admittedly, right? You know, depending on the hunt. But so, and I'll just keep that plate right in the tripod, and it's a matter of, it's literally plug and play. You take your binoculars, you plug it in, you start glassing.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, Joe's got me convinced on running a tripod with my binos. I've always been reticent to do that because I just like having my binos right in my bino bivy. I can pull them out at any second and glass something up. But gosh, glassing in that big country, Joe sits down, and I mean, his binos are so steady, he just picks out everything. And I'll find it too eventually, but just that little tiny bit of movement when you're looking 2-3 miles away is enough to where I might miss something. And Joe's on it immediately with his binos. And then just real quick before we let you go, Mark, you know, you got your regular range finder, and then you got your range finding binoculars. If you're an archery hunter, are you going to get range finding binos, or are you going to maybe just go with a regular range finding setup? What are the situations where, you know, you might require binos versus just a standard range finder?
Yeah, you know, a lot of that's going to come down to personal preference. There's a lot of guys out there, a lot of folks that are, you know, archery hunting with a range finding binocular, and you most certainly can do that. And like I said, personal preference for me, you know, I'm probably going to go with a handheld. I like the form factor. I like that, you know, it's a little bit easier to hold steady with one hand. I like the lower magnification because I'm generally trying to look at something at a closer range. And I also use, you know, I use the Razer HD 4000, and I actually use it almost like a monocular, you know, in close quarter scenarios when I want to just get that quick look, but I want to minimize movement. So generally for me, archery hunting, I'm going with a handheld rangefinder, like a traditional more, monocular style rangefinder. And then I've got my, 10 by 42s or my 12 by 50s on my chest.
He's Mark Boardman of VortexOptics.com and the Vortex Nation podcast. They also got a absolutely killer YouTube channel. Mark, thank you so much. Go look at those Sitka dates, dude. And if you can come up fishing in the summer after you get done killing Yogi Bear up there with Robbo and Joey, man, we'd love to have you on the other end of a big old halibut and send you back to Wisconsin with some white meat back there, buddy.
And Mark, blackmouth.
And
we have to say blackmouth every segment.
We do. So this is the all blackmouth show.
This is the all blackmouth show.
Have yourself a great weekend, buddy. Stay warm back there, my friend.
No, thank you, guys. Yeah, Tom, I'm working on my pitch as we speak.
Let your wife listen to this podcast, and just start leaving a lot of fish and chip suggestions around the house. Honey, wouldn't it be nice too? Yeah. Mark Boardman, thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Later, man.
Hey, thank you, guys. Take care.
See you, buddy.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Coming up next, a critically acclaimed, award-winning Northwest Outdoor Report right here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
The Northwest Outdoor Report, also known as Redneck Sports Center, is brought to you by Truck Vault, the leader in secure vehicle storage.
The North of Falcon salmon season setting process kicked off yesterday with WDFW announcing the salmon forecast for Puget Sound and the Columbia River. One highlight, the 1.7 million coho that are forecast to hit the Washington coast this summer, most of which are headed for the Columbia River. Another highlight is the run of over 2.9 million pink salmon forecast to hit Puget Sound. Most of the Puget Sound rivers will also see an increase of coho, except for the Hood Canal, which dropped from a forecast of 107,000 last year down to 84,000 this year. According to Dave Johnson at Kitsap Marina, who is heavily involved in North of Falcon, it should be enough to allow for some coho fishing in Hood Canal, though. On the coast, the Queech River coho run will likely complicate things in marine areas 2 through 4, as the wild coho forecast for the Queech is down 50% from last year. It's fair to say that managers will have to figure out a way to provide coastal fisheries while protecting those wild Queech River coho.
Columbia River Chinook runs better than last year. Biologists are predicting an uptick in the king salmon run on the Columbia River this year, with a total run size of 580,000 fall Chinook back to the Big Creek. Last year, they forecast 431 kings, and the run ended up coming in well above that at 574,000 kings, which resulted in solid ocean Chinook and a scorching buoy 10 season. The bulk of this year's runs are the prized upriver brights, with a forecast return of just over 354,000 Chinook.
In Puget Sound, the Chinook returns look slightly down from last year. The only exception is the Puyallup and Hoodsport that are both forecasted to see an increase in run size. The rest of the Chinook run forecast in Puget Sound are either static or decreasing this year, which will prove challenging for crafting fishing seasons.
Kane Brand from Heavy Hitter Guide Service in Eastern Washington says the walleye bite has been excellent in the Tri-Cities area. Kane's been jigging with half and three-quarter ounce Norisada blade baits. They're based out of Spokane and has had no problem catching walleye. He said they found plenty of keepers in the 16 to 19-inch range on his last trip, and then found a few oversized walleye in the 5 to 6-pound range as well. Brand said the key to catching those walleye was bow control, though, and keeping the line straight up and down. He was fishing 15-pound braid for main line and 12-pound leader, fishing his blade baits. Blade baits, remember that, right on the bottom, where the walleye are holding. He thinks the fishery will only get better in the next couple of months. You can find Kane online at heavyhitterguideservice.com.
Marine Area 5 opens for winter blackmouth. Here we go. MA5 and CQ opens for winter blackmouth on Monday, March 1st. The weather looks like it's laying down just in time for the opener, with west winds to 10 and wind waves 1 foot or less. With the closure in most of Puget Sound, CQ's bracing for the impact of a whole bunch of salmon-starved anglers hitting town. Word on the street is most of the motels are flying the no-vacancy neon for the opener. Marine Area 5 slated to stay open through April 15th, and the fishing should only get better as more and more blackmouth migrate out of Puget Sound and into the CQ area. The boat launch will be open at Mason's Resort, and you get moorage, ice, bait, and lodging, maybe, right at Mason's Resort.
It's no secret that COVID has driven people to the woods and the water this past year, and that's translated to a drastic increase in the number of people fishing and hunting. That increase is translated to a big bump in federal funding distributed to all 50 states through the Wildlife and Sport Fish Restoration Program. The funds are generated through the sale of firearms, fishing equipment, and motorboat fuel revenues. WDFW's Sport Fish Restoration Program will receive just under $6.8 million from the program, and the Wildlife Restoration Program will get over $12.8 million in funding. This is great news in a time when funding for fish and wildlife programs always seem to be on the chopping block.
WDFW just announced a short smelt dip netting opener in the Cowlitz for this coming Tuesday. The opener is from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Tuesday, March 2nd. Open area extends from the Highway 432 bridge on the Cowlitz up to Al Hellenberg Memorial Boat Ramp upstream of the Highway 411 bridge in Castle Rock. Each dip netter may retain 10 pounds of smelt, which is about a quarter of a 5-gallon bucket. No license is required to participate in the smelt fishery on the Cowlitz River.
This Redneck Sports Center has been brought to you by the great folks at Truck Vault in Cedro Woolley. Check out your next secure vehicle storage system at truckvault.com.
I'll be heading to get my limit of smelt right after the show.
You already got your limit of smelt this week, didn't you? You got 3,000 pounds of smelt or something for the bait show. Are you making that into crab bait or some kind of scent thing or what the hell?
No, we package them. I'm leaving right from here and going down and getting another probably 12 or 1,500 pounds.
Oh, are they sturgeon bait?
About a half a pound per bag,
yeah.
Vacuum pack them and blast freeze them. And yeah, all sturgeon bait pretty much.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
You know what else? A lot of them I ship to Montana.
Really?
Yeah.
Flathead Lake?
Well, I have a account in Billings and an account in Missoula. And they use them for ice fishing for pike.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Huh.
Crazy.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Ice fishing for pike is not a segment we've ever done on the Outdoor
Show. I watched a show the other day. I was watching some bass fishing, just trying to, you know, learn a little bit more about bass fishing. And then the show that came on next was ice fishing for pike. And, man, it looks fun. And
totally fun. Now, plus you can drink a lot while you're sitting there ice fishing, right?
Now they have it's high tech. It's not just sitting there with a fishing rod. You have
No, there's a sounder.
Well, yeah. you have a sounder, but also have this little round thing that fits over the hole. It's got basically the line on it with a drag system, and when that pike grabs, the flag goes up, and it allows the pike to just kind of swim away, and you run over there, and you basically handline them in.
Super
I want to go
fun,
do
man.
It. It'd be cool to go do it.
Yesterday in Wisconsin, a chunk of ice broke off on this huge lake back there, and 60 people were on the ice
in their
little huts. Well, they didn't even know. And so the guy gets out, and he's like ready to go home. He's like, son of a gun. We got no way to get home. So they had to rescue all these people, helicopters. They were running skiffs out there to get them. And crazy deal back in Wisconsin. It just popped up right before the show. I was going to write it into the report, actually, but it just popped up right before the show, this crazy thing that just happened back in Wisconsin. Everybody's ice fishing back there right now. Minnesota, Wisconsin, everywhere back there, it's happening. Montana, I try to get David Draper on for Peterson's Hunting. He's like, no, I'm going to be ice fishing, man. He's been out the last 2 weeks.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal.
We ship hundreds of cases of bait to those two accounts. All of it in the wintertime for
Excuse me.
Ice fishing.
I can't talk about salmon if you guys are going to talk about ice fishing for pike. Okay. All right. Now we got to get back to salmon.
Sorry. No,
we got to get right back to salmon. Okay. So check it out. Hatchery-wild-coexist.com started a few years ago. Dave Champ is the guy behind this. And so basically we have seen hatchery fish get a bad rap from a lot of different sources. And so look, hatchery fish are not the problem, okay? The problem is, let's talk to Dave Champ about that next. Dave Champ, Hatchery Wild Coexist, joining us next here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
Get in, sit down, hold on, and listen up. You're in the RenaissanceMarineGroup.com's Wheelhouse, brought to you by Wellcraft, Duckworth, and Northwest Boats.
Well, welcome to the Wheelhouse here on 710 ESPN's The Outdoor Line. There's no doubt that since actually the mid-90s, hatchery production, at least in the state of Washington, peaked. And now we are down over 100 million hatchery fish a year since that particular slash, okay? hatchery fish have gotten a bum rap on a lot of different fronts. And I really was unaware of any other group that was trying to push back on this until Dave Shamp came on board with hatchery-wild-coexist.com. Dave Shamp joining us this morning. Good morning, Dave, and welcome to the show.
Morning, Dave.
Hey, guys.
Morning.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Thanks for taking the time, man. What do you guys got going on there with Hatchery Wild Coexist? I've seen it floating around a little bit here for the last year or so, and talking to some of the guys, Gabe Miller and some of the other folks up here that are involved with it. I got a brief introduction to it from some of those guys. Why don't you tell us what you have going on there, buddy?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to have the opportunity to share a little bit about Hatchery Wild Coexist. So we kicked off this campaign in February of 2019, coincided with the Portland Sportsman Show. And, you know, like Nelly mentioned, hatcheries have been getting a bad rap for decades, but they are incredibly important, not only for providing abundant fisheries, but they also have an important role when it comes to wild fish recovery. So the campaign is focused on just that, providing the facts, providing the information that's been largely swept under the rug when it comes to the good that our hatcheries are doing. You know, in Washington, I think WDFW has about 160 hatcheries that they're responsible for. And out of that 160, almost 25%, 35 of those hatcheries have a specific conservation goal. So they're focused on preventing extinction of runs, reintroducing extirpated species. So areas where these fish no longer existed, hatcheries are being used to reestablish those fish, and they're being used to increase abundance of wild fish populations. So to just make a blanket statement that hatcheries are bad and hatcheries are causing the decline of wild fish is simply not true. And we need to let people know what the real facts are.
And if you're interested in studying this, it's real easy to lay the hatchery production of the state of Washington abundance and lay the abundance of the southern resident killer whale orcas right on top of it. You will see that after hatchery production of salmonids peaked in the state of Washington, so did the SRKWs. And now we're to a point where we finally realize that as a state, starting to make more fish now. But what I really am encouraged about, Dave, is the dismissal of the HSRG here in the state of Washington. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how artificial caps on hatchery production have really got us to where we are today?
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, HSRG, there's a lot of talk about that. And understandably, I would say probably 90% of anglers in Oregon and Washington have no clue what HSRG is. And it was really federally, I don't know if it was mandated, go ahead.
It was not federally mandated. It was at the time, it was a way to get through the Endangered Species Act. But go ahead.
So it was federally funded, if I'm not mistaken, review of hatchery practices, and it was intended to look at both Oregon and Washington. Oregon got out in front of it and didn't rely on HSRG science, and Washington has. And it was put together as a set of recommendations, but Washington basically said, okay, we're going to take all those recommendations and we're going to make them policy. And I don't know that that was ever the intent. And it has hamstrung the hatchery production in the state of Washington. You know, you were mentioning the correlation between the orca decline and the reduction of hatchery production in Washington. So the orca decline started in around 1995. Well, in the late 1980s, as you mentioned, that's when Washington really started to ratchet down their hatchery production. So in 1987, almost 280 million salmon were released in Washington from Washington hatcheries. In 2017, 30 years later, half that, 140 million salmon are being released. Well, it's no wonder that these species that rely on those fish as forage are starving. There's no fish there for them to eat.
Yeah, and the habitat can't carry the wild fish that we're trying to recover up here anyway. And it's just we're in a real conundrum up here in the situation that we're in. And then we were talking yesterday, Dave, you know, right now our steelhead fisheries here in Western Washington are just in the toilet. We have very little opportunity up here. But you go down to Oregon, and it's boom time down there, man. The coastal fisheries, there's boat trailers running up and down the rivers, and there's drift boats everywhere, and people catching steelhead, and there's plenty of opportunity down there. It's just a real stark contrast to what we're seeing up in this neck of the woods, buddy.
Boy, you're absolutely right. And it's, in my opinion, largely due to a different philosophy when it comes to hatchery management. You know, in your neck of the woods, they basically said, in order to recover our wild fish, we have to shut down our hatchery production. In Oregon, they have been utilizing wild broodstock programs. So while they've ratcheted down the number of fish that are being produced in our hatcheries, they're using wild parents for the next generation of fish. And you see a higher return rate on those fish that have wild parents. And you're absolutely right. One of the big problems, I guess, if you can truly say it's a problem, the success of the wild broodstock programs have put tremendous pressure on these rivers. So a lot of the locals, a lot of guys that have been fishing these rivers for years are saying, hey, you know, we need to get rid of these broodstock programs because they're creating too much pressure.
Well, too successful.
Our view is, my view is,
do
what
it
we
more.
Need to do is institute those broodstock programs in more rivers
exactly.
and spread that pressure. Because, fishing, two fish limits down here, you know, catch and release obviously on wilds, but we can use bait, and get this, we're still fishing out of boats, baby.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Stop being mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, real quick, Dave, Patagonia came out with a film, I think, was it last year, called Artificial, that just damned hatchery fish altogether. Can you talk about some of the things that were highlighted in that film and maybe discuss some of the high points or low points in that film in regards to hatchery production here in the Northwest, man?
Yeah, that film, Artificial, was released about 2 years ago. I think it was in the spring of 2019. And it's an hour and a half long film that goes to extremes to show problems, according to them, caused by hatcheries. And it is littered with misinformation, misrepresentations. It shows the extremes that wild fish advocates will go to promote their anti-hatchery agenda. You know, they blame hatcheries for the reduction in the orca population. Well, it's the exact opposite of that. We just talked about that. I think one thing that is most egregious is they point to the Madison River in Montana in the mid-1970s when catchable-size rainbow trout catchable-size rainbow trout plants were removed from the Madison River, and there was this explosion of, according to them, wild fish abundance. Well, there was definitely an increase in wild fish abundance, but those wild fish were German brown trout. That's an invasive species. So they're going, they have to go all the way back to 1974. They have to go to Montana. They have to talk about catchable size rainbow trout and the explosion of an invasive species to try and make their case that if you remove hatchery fish, you're going to see an increase in wild fish. Well, why would they go to such an extreme? The answer is obvious, because they don't have good, solid examples in the Pacific Northwest where hatchery fish have been removed, and we see an increase in wild populations.
Yeah, we've seen it. That didn't work. And look, so I've watched that film, and Tom and I kind of talked about this morning. I'm not an expert, but I know a lot about hatcheries and fish. So I'm watching this thing, and I'm like, well, that's not true. What sucks is there's a lot of people out there who don't know as much as we probably do, and they watch that, and they think everything that they're telling them is true, and it's a bunch of bull. And I couldn't believe some of the stuff that was in there. That just like what you said, they removed the hatchery rainbow trout and introduce a invasive species.
Yeah, exactly.
Brown trout.
It's right. Crazy.
But they don't say that. Didn't tell people that in the film.
No. They don't tell you they're an invasive species. So one of the things that Hatchery Wild Coexist is doing right now, underway, is producing a series of videos. And the first one is a counter to artificial. And the name of the Hatchery Wild Coexist video is beneficial. So what we do is go through and point out some of these misrepresentations and false information that's included in the artificial film and point out the benefits of hatcheries when it comes to wild fish recovery, providing abundant fisheries, and doing what we can to keep our orcas from starving. So we're excited. That should be released here in the next 3 weeks, month.
We can't wait to see it. And please let us know when that drops, Dave, if we haven't heard about it already. I'd sure like to, and I definitely want to keep in touch with you. And I kind of want to end with this. It's like, not all hatchery operations since the beginning of hatcheries have operated cleanly and operated to minimize wild fish impacts. Okay, I get it. Every science on the planet continues to evolve. Every technology on the planet continues to evolve. To take some historical evidence of a hatchery program and think that things haven't changed on the hatchery front in all these years is nothing less than a fallacy. Hatcheries are an essential tool in not only providing sustainable fisheries, but also backing up a lot of wild fish. Hatcheries are a tool. If the tool's not doing the job you wish it to do, you don't blame the tool. You use the tool differently, and that's why I think we're going to see increased hatchery plants here in the region, and they're going to be successful. Dave Shamp.
You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, in the early days, our hatchery practices were not good. We've learned a tremendous amount over the course of the last century, most notably in the last several decades. And, you know, if you look at the amount of science, the study, the effort, the money that's gone into focusing on the negative aspects of hatcheries, and we instead have been using that money to focus on the benefits and find ways to improve our hatchery practices, we'd be in a totally different situation today. And that's what we need to do. We need to re-energize our hatcheries, but we need to make sure that they're being operated in the most responsible way possible to do everything we can to make sure the fish being released are helping our wild fish and not causing problems with our wild fish.
And as you say on your website, it's not hatchery versus wild, it's hatchery and wild coexist. You can jump on their website, hatchery-wild-coexist.com, and get the latest news, and you can contribute to. Dave Shamp, thank you for your time, my friend, and we will definitely be in touch. You please keep in touch with us as well.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thank Absolutely. You, Dave. All right, see you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks, David.
Weekend.
Talk to you soon. And again, I view Hatchery Wild Coexist as nothing short of a litmus test for other organizations. If there's an organization out there you're considering supporting and they do not support Hatchery Wild Coexist, they don't deserve your support either. Coming up next, the hottest report we heard all week in the techniques you need to succeed. It's RoyRobinsonChevy.com's Really? Where? And it's next here in the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
No way.
You gotta be kidding me.
Really? Where?
It's coming back. The island of Tinian the Lady.
Where'd you get him, man? No way. You gotta tell me. I'm not gonna tell anybody.
The ocean turned red.
Hey, man, can you tell me where you got him?
I'll never put on a life jacket again.
Welcome to RoyRobinsonChevy.com's
Really?
Where?
Where?
Roy Robinson Chevrolet RV will take you anywhere.
Really?
Head over to Roy Robinson Chevrolet. You're going to find the best deal on the best pickup truck out there, the all-new 2021 Chevy Silverado 3/4 ton. Rob Ensley, what do you got, buddy?
We got just over a minute here. We got steelhead fishing going on the coast, Skagit, Cowlitz River. Actually, Kevin John from Holiday Sports just texted in. He just got a big load of rubber worms in the shop today. They've been just getting mowed down up there. Everybody's fishing rubber worms now for wild steelhead. But hit up Kevin. He sent me a couple pictures of a couple of big boxes of worms that just got in up there. Blackmouth fishing opens this Monday in Area 5. Had some questions about putting scent on your spoons, hoochies, flashers, whatever. Yes, we definitely use scent. Downrigger Dynamite, we're a big fan of Pro-Cure Downrigger Dynamite. If you're going to do that stuff, don't put it on the shiny side of anything. And if I put it on my flashers, I put it just on the trailing edge of the flasher just to release some scent, downstream of that flasher a little bit. But if you got any plated silver, anything on your spoons, put it on the opposite side of that. But yeah, we definitely run a lot of scent on our stuff. One little sleeper here that you want to check out is the Rogue River down in Oregon. We were just talking to Dave Champ about Oregon a little bit, but talking about fishing down there, the forecasts are excellent for the Rogue River. So we got to run. We're up against a break. Thanks for listening.
Miss any of the show, hit theoutdoorline.com for podcast. Give us a follow during the week at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at The Outdoor Line. For Rob Ensley, down a gig. For Joey Pyburn here in the studio, Matt Nelson, our Seattle studios. This is Tom Nelson. This has been The Outdoor Line on 710 ESPN, Seattle.